When Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door was published in 1969, it sent shockwaves through American society. Rejected by dozens of publishers before finding a home, this revolutionary novel became an underground sensation that spoke truth to power during the height of the civil rights movement. The book was so controversial that when it was adapted into a film in 1973, the FBI allegedly pressured theaters to stop showing it, effectively erasing it from public view for decades. Yet its influence persisted, with figures from Chuck D to Boots Riley citing it as a formative text in their political awakening. Beyond its radical politics, the novel offers a masterclass in code-switching, institutional racism, and the psychological toll of being black in America. At its core stands Dan Freeman, a character whose complexity and contradictions make him not just a revolutionary figure, but a mirror reflecting America's unfulfilled promises of equality. Senator Gilbert Hennington confronts a critical political crisis in Washington. His recent impassioned speech supporting a temporary halt on civil rights legislation, delivered to appease his conservative donor base, has created a severe backlash among black voters in his district. With re-election numbers plummeting and pressure mounting from party leadership, Hennington desperately needs to rehabilitate his image among minority constituents without alienating his white supporters. His politically astute wife, Belinda, known for her behind-the-scenes strategic counsel, proposes an ingenious solution. Publicly challenge the CIA's discriminatory hiring practices. This calculated move would position Hennington as a champion of racial equality while attacking an easy target, the notoriously secretive intelligence agency. During a carefully orchestrated Senate watchdog committee hearing, Hennington confronts CIA Director Phillips with pointed questions about minority representation. Phillips, caught off guard, makes the catastrophic mistake of speaking candidly, admitting they have no black officers and declaring African Americans aren't ready for intelligence work. Belinda ensures maximum impact by strategically leaking the explosive exchange to Mark Townsend, an influential columnist known for his coverage of civil rights issues. The political choreography proves masterful. African American community leaders, previously critical of Hennington, praise his courage in confronting institutional racism. Editorial pages celebrate his principled stand. His poll numbers rebound dramatically, leading to a comfortable re-election victory. Yet beneath this veneer of progressive politics lies a deeper cynicism. Carter Summerfield, the senator's Harvard-educated black assistant, observes this performance with practiced detachment. Despite his intimate knowledge of both the black community's struggles and the workings of Washington, he maintains a carefully calibrated silence. His position requires him to be visible enough to demonstrate Hennington's inclusiveness, yet invisible enough to never challenge the power structure. When other staffers discuss the CIA controversy, Summerfield offers only neutral observations. He's learned that his role is to be a prop in white politicians' performances of liberal values, not an actual agent of change. This opening sequence establishes the novel's central theme: the sophisticated ways white institutions manipulate racial representation while preserving fundamental power imbalances. Hennington's manufactured confrontation with the CIA reveals how surface-level criticism of racism can actually serve to strengthen existing hierarchies. The CIA director's unguarded admission exposes not just individual prejudice, but the deep-seated institutional belief in white supremacy. Most significantly, Summerfield's strategic self-effacement illustrates the complex calculations black professionals must make in white-dominated spaces, constantly weighing visibility against vulnerability. The political chessboard is thus arranged for Dan Freeman's entrance, not as another piece to be moved by others, but as a player who understands that real change requires a much longer and more subversive game. Dan Freeman arrives at his CIA interview deliberately underdressed to please the crackers. Unlike other black recruits eager to be firsts integrating the agency, Freeman feels no pride in the role. He has simply come to stay, a phrase that reveals his determination to endure whatever necessary to achieve his hidden purpose. At the training facility, Freeman maintains a disciplined routine while other recruits socialize. He carefully crafts a ghetto persona with limited vocabulary and pronounced accent, understanding that whites will see exactly what they expect to see. When a suspicious recruit from the Kappa fraternity approaches him, Freeman dismisses fraternity membership as silly, effectively ending the conversation. As training progresses, recruits are systematically eliminated, all part of the CIA's plan to demonstrate that integration efforts will fail. Freeman excels in every area, particularly marksmanship, where he impresses a Marine gunnery sergeant enough to receive special training. When instructor Calhoun, a racist North Carolinian, challenges Freeman to a judo match, expecting to humiliate him, Freeman systematically defeats him, dislocating Calhoun's shoulder. Freeman realizes he must be more careful. There are holes in his mask. The training school director reports Freeman's unexpected success to his superior, noting Freeman's peculiar ability to fade into the background. People can't remember his face or words even minutes after speaking with him. According to Soo, the Korean martial arts instructor, Freeman could have killed Calhoun and is one of the finest natural judoists of his experience. Despite this, the officials dismiss Freeman as slow-witted and a plotter, unsuitable for field work, but possibly useful at headquarters. Freeman's performance is a masterclass in psychological warfare. He understands that white supervisors will underestimate him if he confirms their racial stereotypes while demonstrating just enough competence to advance. His carefully calibrated persona, intelligent enough to complete training but not threatening enough to alarm white superiors, allows him to navigate a hostile institution while gathering the skills he'll need for his true mission. Freeman becomes the last trainee standing, finishing the course alone after others leave without goodbyes. During a 3-week break, he creates 2 distinct personas. In Washington, he plays the role expected of him, the token Negro pioneer at the CIA. But in New York, he briefly reclaims his true self, visiting jazz clubs, Broadway shows, and art galleries. He meticulously manages these separate identities, knowing whites saw in most Negroes exactly what they most wanted to see. The CIA investigates Freeman by questioning his Washington prostitute, who defends him against insinuations about drug use, gambling, or unusual sexual preferences. The investigator's prurient interest in these details reveals more about him than about Freeman. After a year in his windowless basement office as the highest-paid copy clerk in Washington, Freeman receives a promotion when the general needs someone to give senators a tour. During the tour, he impresses Senator Hennington, who had helped get him the job. Following this successful interaction, Freeman is appointed special assistant to the director, essentially to be black and conspicuous as proof the CIA was integrated. This position gives him access to most of the general's briefings and meetings. Freeman maintains his cover meticulously while secretly practicing combat skills, becoming the best undercover man the CIA had. His double life extends to his personal relationships as well. With Joy, a former girlfriend from Michigan State University, he maintains a weekly relationship while seeing the Dahamey Queen regularly. Joy challenges Freeman about his career, wanting him to pursue law or politics rather than return to social work in Chicago. Freeman realizes she desires the status of being Mrs. Lawyer Freeman or Mrs. Congressman Freeman, while he rejects abandoning his principles. Their relationship deteriorates when Freeman discovers Joy seeing a light-skinned medical student from a prominent Detroit family, teaching her that her background would always limit her acceptance in black society. Freeman's double consciousness, living simultaneously as the CIA's token black employee and as a revolutionary planning liberation, takes a psychological toll. He must constantly monitor his behavior, speech patterns, and emotional responses. The exhaustion of this performance reveals the burden many Black professionals carry in predominantly white institutions where authenticity often comes at the cost of advancement. Freeman becomes the general's trusted administrative assistant, though still primarily used as a showpiece. He masters the art of making simple tasks appear difficult while performing them flawlessly. The general takes him on domestic and international trips, and Senator Hennington uses Freeman to bolster his liberal reputation by occasionally lunching with him in the Senate dining room. Freeman moves through Washington like an invisible man, occasionally invited to Georgetown cocktail parties for African diplomats, but never to formal dinners. He avoids Washington's Black society entirely, dating rarely and maintaining only brief relationships. Meanwhile, Freeman studies guerrilla warfare tactics from Algeria, the Philippines, Malaya, and Vietnam, analyzing the theories of Giap and Mao Zedong. He accompanies the general to Saigon 4 times, staying at the Hotel Caravel and learning to navigate the war-torn city. Through his travels across Asia, he acquires both material goods and cultural knowledge, becoming adept with chopsticks and expanding his sexual education Oriental style. Though enjoying the job's privileges and the satisfaction of putting on so many white people, a lunch with the general reveals the limits of his acceptance. During a meal at a steakhouse, the general reveals his deeply patronizing views, praising Freeman as a credit to your race, while suggesting Black people are naturally athletic but intellectually inferior. He claims African development lagged centuries behind Europeans, framing civil rights activism as needless agitation. Freeman maintains his composure through sheer will, excusing himself only to become violently ill in the restaurant bathroom, his mask of calm nearly breaking as he confronts the general's true beliefs. Afterward, Freeman returns to his apartment, drinks scotch in a hot bath while watching news footage of police violence against civil rights protesters. Resolving to stop procrastinating, he writes to Chicago social welfare agencies about job openings and requests a meeting with the general to resign, explaining he wants to work among his people. This pivotal moment crystallizes Freeman's transformation. Despite years of education, international travel, and professional achievement, he remains just a credit to his race in the general's eyes, never fully human, never an equal. The general's casual racism, delivered over lunch as if discussing the weather, represents the final straw that propels Freeman from passive infiltrator to active revolutionary. Freeman leaves the CIA with quiet dignity, carrying only an attaché case with his personal belongings. Standing in the Virginia sunshine, he reflects on the government building as an ugly abscess in the beautiful woods. His carefully cultivated appearance, slightly ill-fitting clothes, gold-rimmed tooth, and shuffling gait has made him well-liked but underestimated. At the White House, Freeman meets briefly with the president, who repeatedly mispronounces his name as Foreman. The president makes patronizing remarks while his nervous aide manages the tightly scheduled 4-minute meeting. When presented with a pocket knife, the same gift given to Boy Scouts earlier, Freeman responds by giving the president his PT boat tie clasp, creating an awkward moment. After leaving the White House, Freeman finally confronts the hostile chauffeur who flicks a cigarette butt at him. "Nigger, if you had hit me with that butt, it would have been your Black ass," he says, dropping his submissive persona. At the airport, Freeman orders the driver to check his bag and bring him his ticket, a final power reversal. Alone at the bar, Freeman reflects on his 5 years of deception. He had conned them all, and in his own way, had been the best of the spooks, and they might never know it. For 5 years, he had been the CIA nigger, and his job had been to sit by the door. This departure scene brilliantly illustrates the psychological liberation that accompanies Freeman's physical departure from the CIA. The White House meeting, where the president can't even remember his name, underscores how invisible Freeman has been despite his position. The confrontation with the chauffeur represents Freeman's first authentic expression of anger after years of strategic submission. His reflection at the airport bar captures both his pride in having successfully infiltrated the CIA and his bitterness at the role he was forced to play. As Freeman boards his flight to Chicago, he has shed his old cover like a snake shedding skin. Gone is the insecure shuffle and subservient smile, replaced by the grace of a well-trained athlete. He has completed the first phase of his mission, acquiring the skills and knowledge needed for revolution, and now moves toward the second, building an army. In Chicago, Freeman establishes a new cover identity as a social worker at the Southside Youth Foundation. Within a month, his apartment perfectly reflects this persona: expensive liquor, high-end stereo equipment, designer furnishings. He slips into this role like a tailored suit, becoming the white type, uptight Negro of rising aspirations. Freeman's first assignment is establishing contact with the Cobras, a street gang resistant to the Foundation's outreach efforts. He reveals he was once the Cobra warlord in his youth, known as Turk. After studying the gang carefully, impressed by their rigid discipline and chain of command, Freeman makes his move. He walks into their pool room headquarters and deliberately takes their table. When confronted by the three leaders, Do Daddy Dean, Sugar Hip Scott, and Stud Davis, he suggests talking outside. In the alley, they attack him, but Freeman skillfully fights them off using martial arts techniques, then holds them at gunpoint with a .38 revolver. He berates them for their amateur tactics during recent riots, making Molotov cocktails, looting stores, and ineffective sniping at police. You didn't do any more damage than a mosquito on an elephant's ass, he tells them, then offers, You really want to fuck with Whitey? I'll show you how. Freeman conducts impromptu training sessions on street corners, teaching the Cobras military skills like calculating sniper ranges using geometry. Sugar, the gang's mathematician, helps others master these calculations. As weather turns cooler, Freeman moves training to the pool room after closing or his apartment. Freeman explains how the Cobra's existing underground structure makes them perfect for revolutionary organization. He educates them about their African heritage and the cultural traditions white America destroyed, teaching them about slave revolts and black heroes absent from standard history books. We took everything they laid on us: slavery, lynching, segregation, the worst damn jobs, the worst damn food, and come up swinging. We been on our ass, but never on our knees. To prevent police suspicion, Freeman orchestrates a deception making authorities believe the gang has become heroin addicts. The police, relieved to see what appears to be a formerly violent gang pacified by drugs, fail to realize the hypodermic scars and dilated pupils are merely props in Freeman's elaborate cover. Freeman's revolutionary strategy isn't to win outright, but to force white America to choose between fucking with us and playing Big Daddy to the world. By tying up troops domestically and stretching America economically thin, they'll expose white America's priorities. His ultimate goal is awakening black pride, that precious thing wrapped up and put away inside that trunk for too long. Spring ends abruptly as hot, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico smothers Chicago, turning the city into a furnace. Ghetto life moves outdoors, onto doorsteps, into air-conditioned bars, and Washington Park, where families sleep on blankets under the stars to escape their stifling rooms. As temperatures rise, tempers shorten, and the ghetto becomes a bomb waiting to explode. The spark comes when a police officer kills a 15-year-old boy beneath the L tracks near 50th Street. The shooting occurs after police confront a group drinking beer. Someone throws a brick, and the officer draws his gun, claiming the boy advanced with a knife. As word spreads, streets fill with angry people, and riot police rush to the scene. As midnight approaches, the crowd begins dispersing when suddenly a police dog unit arrives against orders. Four white handlers with snarling Alsatians and a Doberman advance into the crowd. They bring in dogs in! Dogs! People shout. A dog lunges at a young boy, and Detective Sergeant Dawson confronts the handler with his gun drawn. Get those dogs out of here! Though the dogs retreat, rumors spread that one had bitten a 3-year-old girl. The riot's aftermath brings predictable reactions. Senator Hennington warns the violence will hurt civil rights legislation. The president remains silent while his press secretary praises Negroes fighting for Vietnamese freedom. Negro leaders make token requests, like sprinklers for fire hydrants and swimming pools. Negro aldermen read identical statements written by the mayor's office condemning hoodlumism while praising the mayor. Freeman calls reporter Victor Feldman to emphasize that the mayor's office bombing was deliberate timing, not a failed assassination attempt. "We blew it when we wanted, and as an advertisement that we mean business," he explains, demanding the National Guard leave the ghetto. Though Feldman's column treats the call humorously, Freeman continues his campaign, predicting and executing increasingly bold actions. Painting a Negro alderman's car yellow and white, sabotaging National Guard vehicles, jamming their radio frequencies, and broadcasting revolutionary messages as Uncle Tom of the Freedom Fighters. In a daring operation, Freeman and his team infiltrate Colonel Bull Evans' command post, kidnap the colonel, dose him with LSD, and leave him in Washington Park Fountain with blackface makeup. The humiliated colonel is found babbling that he had met the most wonderful niggers in the world. The National Guard responds to their commander's humiliation with unbridled violence, roaming the streets with weapons ready, firing at anything that moves. Casualties mount as panicky soldiers fire indiscriminately, once unleashing .50 caliber machine guns on an apartment building over a rumored sniper, killing a mother of four. Freeman orders sniper teams deployed on rotation, with one-third active each night. That night, Studd and Freeman execute their mission flawlessly, killing the quad 50 gunner with synchronized shots before disappearing into the night. Across the city, other freedom fighter teams engage in similar operations, killing 6 and wounding 19 guardsmen without taking casualties. Colonel Evans is relieved of command after his kidnapping, though newspapers claim he heroically escaped his captors. The president orders the 82nd Airborne Division to relieve the National Guard in Chicago. Meanwhile, Freeman has been organizing underground units in 12 major cities since January, sending his most adaptable gang members to establish new identities and recruit local street gangs. 9 of these units are now combat ready, with 3 others developing. Freeman has built an extensive intelligence network, including bus drivers, taxi drivers, postal workers, medical personnel, and even police officers. The CIA deploys counterinsurgency teams to Chicago under a general's supervision, implementing Operation Law and Order to infiltrate Freeman's organization and eliminate its leader. One evening, Freeman receives a mysterious phone call from the Dahomey Queen, his former lover from Washington. She reveals she's working for a general hunting the freedom fighters, the same general Freeman once worked for. She's come to warn him, having pieced together that Freeman is involved with the resistance. The freedom fighters' rebellion has spread nationwide, with Oakland, Los Angeles, Harlem, and South Philadelphia erupting in coordinated uprisings. Within a week, guerrilla warfare engages police, National Guard, and eventually elite military troops in 8 major cities. On a cool autumn evening, Freeman entertains joy in his apartment, the city lights twinkling beyond his windows like distant stars. The meeting reveals deepening fissures in the black community's response to mounting racial tensions. Joy, elegantly dressed and clearly successful, is bitter about the freedom fighters' activities. She articulates the fears of the black middle class, complaining that decent black people are losing their hard-won positions in integrated workplaces because of the uprising. Her husband, the only black doctor at a prestigious white hospital, has already lost his position, a casualty of growing white paranoia. Joy herself fears losing her coveted role as a department store buyer, one of the few black women to achieve such a position in retail. Later that evening, Freeman faces a pivotal confrontation with his longtime friend Dawson, who has risen to police sergeant, a position that symbolizes both progress and compromise. The tension is palpable as Freeman makes an impassioned, desperate plea for Dawson to join the freedom fighters. Dawson's refusal is cutting, as he labels Freeman a hypocrite for using the Cobras, seeing them as thugs rather than soldiers for justice. Freeman's raw admission that he is indeed an Uncle Tom and will employ any means necessary for freedom marks a crucial moment of self-awareness and determination. The confrontation escalates rapidly. When Dawson attempts to arrest him, Freeman's training takes over. In the violent struggle that follows, Dawson manages to wound Freeman with his service weapon, but Freeman's superior combat skills prove decisive. With a precise neck strike, a technique learned during his CIA training, Freeman kills his former friend, marking a point of no return in his revolutionary journey. Understanding that his cover is irretrievably compromised, Freeman springs into action despite his bleeding wound. He summons his lieutenants to remove Dawson's body and initiates Condition Red, the signal to activate all attack teams across the nation. His instructions to his men are both tactical and psychological. Hit them everywhere and use his strength and cockiness against him, revealing his strategic understanding of both warfare and white America's vulnerabilities. As his lieutenants depart with Dawson's body, Freeman observes them with a mixture of pride and melancholy, recognizing that they've matured into capable leaders who no longer need his guidance. Wounded and drinking alone in his apartment, he listens to the cascading sounds of combat erupting across the city. He finds solace in Billie Holiday's haunting rendition of God Bless the Child, its lyrics about self-reliance taking on new meaning as his revolution unfolds. The most powerful nation in history teeters on the brink of unprecedented chaos as the Black resistance proves impossible to contain or eliminate. Greenlee masterfully leaves Freeman's ultimate fate unresolved. The open-ended conclusion poses challenging questions about America's racial dynamics and future. Will Freeman survive his wound? Will his carefully planned revolution succeed in transforming American society? His evolution from CIA infiltrator to revolutionary leader serves as both a stark warning about the consequences of systemic racism and a powerful testament to the human spirit's unquenchable thirst for freedom, regardless of the personal cost.